It's a very difficult concept for people to understand in the marketplace. It's irritating and frustrating.
The state releases its report on gas prices in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 12th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage budget cuts aimed at the fire department.
Instead of us being there in 4 minutes, we might be there in 4 minutes and 10 seconds or 4 minutes and 30 seconds.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. If you're an artist who expresses yourself creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance, you may be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Awards grant. You can learn more online at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The Department of Law today released the results of an investigation that found no indication of collusion or other illegal pricing activity in the gasoline and heating fuel markets in the state. Instead, the report by Assistant Attorney General Ed Sniffen determined that the volatility in rising prices last year and the slow price decline at the end of the year could be explained by market-driven factors. The report was made during a Senate hearing on a bill that would define and prevent price gouging in energy fuels by making it illegal to charge exorbitant or excessive prices. Sponsor Bill Wilikowski said the market cannot regulate itself in Alaska because Alaska is an oligopoly.
Basically, what it means is you have a small market. We don't have a free market here in Alaska for gasoline prices. And when you don't have a free market, you have essentially one refiner, Tesoro, which controls the vast amount of the refining capacity here in Alaska, and Flint Hills to a much smaller degree. And they're able to set prices at any level that they desire.
He says Alaskans are paying for the decisions made at the refineries, and they are rightfully angry when they see increasing price differences between Alaska and the lower 48, especially when there is no justification for the difference. Kip Knudsen is with the Tesoro Refinery in Kenai. He says the economics of the industry point to making enough aviation fuel to supply Anchorage and Fairbanks. Fuel for motor vehicles and heating offer smaller markets for the company.
We don't make profit from high prices. We make profit from the difference. We make a profit or a loss in the difference between the inputs, cost of the inputs, and the price we can finally charge to our customers. So when gas prices were exceptionally high, we were actually losing money. It's a very difficult concept for people to understand in the marketplace. It's irritating and frustrating, but ultimately we only make the profit when there's a difference in the price of inputs to the price we charge.
Knudsen also says that crude oil that Tesoro gets from Alaska production is not enough for the markets it services. The company has to import 25% of its oil from Norway, Nigeria, and Indonesia. And he challenges Wilikowski's bill as a price cap or a price control measure. Wilikowski says Alaska's consumers should not have to subsidize the refineries so the refineries can make aviation fuel.
And Alaskans are tired of bailouts. Alaskans are sick and tired of subsidizing large businesses at their expense. Alaskans are tired of paying these huge costs so that large corporations can pay multi-million dollar bonuses to their executives.
In presenting the Department of Law report, Ed Sniffen said he found that when prices increase, the last item added to inventory sets the sales price. However, when costs decline, they don't play a key role in the price of gas. Only competition does. The city of Unalaska, a former military base during World War II, plans to sue the federal government for $4 million, the cost to clean up contaminants left at an old military site. KUCB's Ann Hillman reports.
Unalaska City Council wants the government to reimburse the city for the $4 million of taxpayer money used to clean up PCBs left at the powerhouse site after World War II. City Attorney Brooks Chandler says the case will take at least a year to complete and could cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, but to not pursue it would be irresponsible.
The view I take of the situation is that overall the presence of PCBs on our island was part and parcel of the common defense of the entire United States during World War II, and that this is simply a delayed cost associated with that defense that is best paid for by the entire country, all of whom benefited from the presence of the military here defending the United States.
Chandler says there's no mechanism under federal law to repay an entity like the city that cleans up a former military site. The Army Corps of Engineers refused to be part of the cleanup process when it began in 2007 and when the cleanup proved to be more extensive than the city originally thought. City Manager Chris Laddick says the Corps looked into the history of the site before responding to the city's requests.
And they came back many months later with a movie that said the PCB spill at this site is due to active war. And here's a short film of bombs going off next to the powerhouse. Therefore, we're not responsible.
The Army Corps of Engineers declined to be interviewed about the current claim, but spokesperson Pat Richardson from the Alaska District issued a statement saying, quote, "The Corps of Engineers' extensive research on the power plant site found evidence that the PCBs were released after the Department of Defense transferred the facility. Therefore, we cannot support an assumption of liability for cleaning up the site. We have received no substantial evidence that would cause us to change our position," unquote. City Manager Laddick disagrees.
While we were digging, we found World War II debris at, you know, 10, 12 feet in depth, which means it has been dug up and somebody threw this stuff in the hole, like barrels and things that can be identified as being World War II waste, quote unquote.
Studies completed during the cleanup also identify the type of PCBs as those used during World War II. Chandler says he thinks the city has enough evidence to win the suit. When the PCB cleanup began 2 years ago, the city initially thought the project would only cost about $500,000. But as they cleaned up the area, they found more contaminants, up to 14 feet deep into the ground. PCBs are found in transformer oils and can cause cancer, reproductive and neurological problems, and pose other health risks. The PCBs from the area are now contained in concrete blocks and in sealed, lined containment areas. To complete the project, the city will cover the entire area in concrete when building the new powerhouse, but the area is now deemed safe. The total project cost is about $4 million. The city of Unalaska hopes to reclaim all or part of that amount from the federal government. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Anchorage Acting Mayor Matt Klayman is targeting the city's fire department in a second round of budget cuts. Klayman announced more than $3 million in cost reductions today. The bulk of those savings come from 12 vacant firefighter and fire command positions that will remain unfilled. Anchorage Fire Chief Craig Goodrich says he wasn't surprised by the cuts. He says they're a logical step towards solving a complicated problem.
We're trying to do the job as well as we possibly can so that we minimize the impact to all services to the city, but at some point it's going to come down to that in probably a pretty serious way. This is a lot of money.
The city is trying to close the gap on a $17 million revenue shortfall. Today's cuts followed more than $7 million in budget trimming last week. Goodrich says rolling temporary closures may be necessary at fire stations across Anchorage.
We are trying to achieve a zero overtime this year, and that coupled with the lack of personnel will put us in a position so that when somebody calls in sick, then we're simply going to have to close down a rig of some kind.
Goodrich says the Anchorage Fire Department answers 130 calls per day. That amounts to about 50,000 runs a year. The majority, about 85%, are medical. He says response times may suffer depending on the day.
So instead of us being there in 4 minutes, we might be there in 4 minutes and 10 seconds or 4 minutes and 30 seconds. But on the other hand, if it's a station that just has one company in it, it could mean a several minute difference in response.
Goodrich says despite the cuts, the fire department is committed to providing the highest quality of care. Today's budget cuts are also directed at transit and the Office of Economic and Community Development. The citywide reductions will result in the loss of 23 positions, including 529 layoffs. Klayman is also taking back approximately a 3% pay raise for senior executives. He says the city is now more than halfway to its goal of closing the budget gap. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Barrow City Council asks for the mayor's resignation.
It's painful. It was a painful process for the entire city council.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
The acting chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, is encouraging TransCanada to start the federal permitting process for an Alaska natural gas pipeline. TransCanada has the state's backing for building a gas line from the North Slope, but the competing project by BP and ConocoPhillips, the Denali project, already started the federal regulatory steps last summer. FERC acting chairman John Wellinghoff says that doesn't mean that TransCanada project is behind. He met yesterday with Mark Myers, the state's new pipeline coordinator. Wellinghoff says his message was that the state should encourage TransCanada to start the process.
The TransCanada people, I think the only thing that I would encourage them to do is to get into pre-filing at FERC. And if they do that, I see them, FERC being able to treat both applications on a fair and equal basis. And from that standpoint, we'll see at the end as to which one may prevail. But I don't see either one as having a leg up at all.
President Obama has said he sees an Alaska gas pipeline project as part of a national energy plan. Wellinghoff says he's gotten that message from the president, too.
Any major energy infrastructure project is a priority for me, and I know it's a priority for Mark Robinson, head of our projects office. So any project of that scale is going to become a priority in our office.
FERC is expected to make its six-month status report on the pipeline to Congress in the coming months. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's hearing promising interest from President Obama on an Alaska gas line. She says in their three conversations in recent weeks, he's brought it up.
In all three occasions, even the one where we're just handshaking across the table, he's made a comment about the gas line.
President Obama has said he wants to see a comprehensive energy plan that includes some expanded development. Murkowski says the focus on natural gas as a cleaner burning fossil fuel makes the Alaska project attractive to the country, not just the state.
He knows that this country is looking for secure sources of clean energy, and natural gas is that. And coming out of Alaska, we've got abundant supplies. But our big problem is how you make it happen. And I think he looks at this as a way to win on domestic production.
Governor Sarah Palin sent a letter to President Obama last week encouraging him to discuss construction of a gas line in an upcoming meeting with Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Obama will visit Canada next week, his first foreign trip since taking office. Barrow City Mayor Michael Stotts announced his resignation from office yesterday at the request of the Barrow City Council. Mayor Stotts had been the target of an investigation into charges he used the city's credit card for his personal use and that he exhibited inappropriate behavior at a conference last fall. From member station KBRW, Janelle Everett has the story from Barrow.
At the request of two Barrow citizens, Dorothy Edwardson and Forrest Olemown, last fall, the city council asked its attorneys from K.L. Gates to conduct an investigation into the allegations. The investigation began in early December, and the findings were presented to the council last week. City Councilman Robert Harcharek, who is serving as acting mayor, says the attorney's report determined the allegations were true. Harcharek says the decision to ask for Mayor Stott's resignation was not an easy task, but now the council has to move forward conducting the people's business.
It's painful. It was a painful process for the entire city council. There was a lot of soul searching there because many of us, including myself, supported Mayor Stotts in the election bid. And then to ask for his resignation was pretty disheartening.
Mayor Stotts will have to reimburse the city just over $17,000. Barrow City Councilman Mike Schultz says there are no winners in this situation.
it's really unfortunate, and it's kind of a bad day for Barrow. I suppose, in my mind, what's most disheartening is that former Mayor Stotz is kind of not accepting responsibility. He said he still doesn't believe he did anything wrong, but since the council thinks he did, he'll agree with them. And I don't see that as coming completely clean and being completely honest with the situation.
City Councilman Lloyd Levitt says the illegal use of the city credit card is surprising, but he is disappointed by the mayor's action regarding the conferences he attended.
And he was our representative, and he didn't represent us very well in any of the conventions he went to. That is the most disappointing part. I do not mind so much about the money. It's the representation we got, and we were misrepresented by Mayor Stotz, and I am very disappointed in that part, especially the representation part. That's what's really getting to me here.
According to the report released by the city's attorney, the mayor spent a considerable amount of time intoxicated when he was supposed to be representing the city at these conferences. Levitt says he believes that was a factor in the mayor's inappropriate behavior.
This never should have happened in the first place. If he had honored the request by the administration and a council member when he was reminded to stop, it shouldn't have gotten this far. But he neglected to stop using the credit card, and he just got snagged into it from there and couldn't stop. And a lot of it had to do with alcohol, I believe, is what I'm seeing here.
City Councilman Schultz, Levitt, and Harcharik say they were all supporters of Mayor Stotz, and all three say the incident gives Barrow a black eye. The Barrow City Council is scheduled to meet next week to declare the mayor's seat vacant until a special election can be held. The council is also expected to name an acting mayor until that time. Stotz was elected mayor of Barrow in 2007. Reporting from Barrow, I'm Janelle Everett.
A Fort Richardson soldier was found dead in his unit's motor pool building Sunday evening. Sergeant Naquan Ronaldo Williams Jr. was found by his platoon sergeant. Williams Jr. was a 32-year-old from Brooklyn, New York. He was a chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear specialist who had been with the 95th Chemical Company at Fort Richardson since April of 2006. An autopsy is being performed by the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. The incident is under investigation by the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command. Next of kin have been notified.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
President Obama's pick to be his science advisor in the White House says the Arctic should be more of a priority. Dr. John Holdren testified today before the Senate Commerce Committee as part of his confirmation process.
I do think that we have been devoting inadequate resources to our ability to operate in the Arctic. I think we are down to two heavy icebreakers in the Coast Guard, both near the end of their operational life. That's a particularly serious problem for our capacity to operate in the Arctic in an era when other countries are expanding their activities there.
Holdren is one of the nation's leading scientists pushing for policies that fight climate change. In the White House, he'll advise President Obama on science issues. Holdren is a professor at Harvard University and director of the Woods Hole Research Center in Massachusetts, which focuses on environmental issues. He says not only is the Arctic changing, but more needs to be done to ensure safety there.
The capacity to respond to oil spills is, in my judgment, also not adequate. And I think we're going to have to take a careful look at how to increase the resources available to the Coast Guard and the other relevant agencies so that we can do a better job in that important region.
Holdren spoke to the Senate Commerce Committee alongside the president's nominee to head the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Dr. Jane Lubchenco fielded questions from Senator Mark Begich, including one about fish farming. Begich pointed out that Alaska has banned it. Lubchenco says while she sees there are legitimate concerns about fish farming, she's not prepared to take it off the table.
It's my view that aquaculture, wherever it is practiced, is a very key element of our food production systems, and that certain types of aquaculture are much more benign in terms of their potential impact on the environment.
NOAA is the federal agency that takes the lead on fish farming policies and practices. Lubchenco did say she wants to see scientifically based information about how to make sure fish farming does not negatively impact wild fisheries.
I don't believe that we have identified the right conditions under which aquaculture is sustainable. I would make that a priority if I were confirmed.
Lubchenco also says decisions about no-take zones should be made with public and stakeholder input.
I have seen firsthand scientific information that suggests that marine protected areas and no-take marine reserves can, in fact, bring huge benefit, both in terms of protecting natural resources and, in some cases, in helping to restore depleted fisheries.
Lubchenco is a professor at Oregon State University. She's one of the nation's most prominent marine biologists. The cruise industry is looking to the Ketchikan business community for support of its efforts to lobby the state legislature. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, cruise lines are asking lawmakers to scale back wastewater discharge restrictions approved by voters 3 years ago.
In 2006, Alaska voters approved a cruise ship initiative that, among other things, created a new state cruise ship passenger tax and an onboard environmental monitoring program called Ocean Rangers. A lesser publicized section of that initiative required cruise lines to meet stricter standards by which they discharge their wastewater. Initiative co-sponsor Gershon Cohen says a voter initiative requires cruise lines to meet federal clean water standards at the time that they discharge into state waters. That means the industry cannot use mixing zones.
Many dischargers do get mixing zones. They're allowed to discharge their waste into public waters, dilute their waste in public waters before it is tested for whether or not it's complying. And the law says that the cruise lines are not allowed to get a mixing zone. They have to meet the standards at the end of pipe, which is in fact what the Clean Water Act intended all along.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation has given the industry until next year to meet the discharge restrictions set forth by voters. But the Alaska Cruise Association, which represents 9 cruise lines that operate in the state, says the standards are unachievable. Rod Flager is a spokesperson for the association. He says the industry is seeking a modification to DEC's wastewater discharge permits for the industry.
And there's no other industry in Alaska or in the United States that we're aware of, whether it be a wastewater plant from a municipality or a mining facility or a fishery that or cannery that is measured at an end of pipe. So it's a standard that's unprecedented anywhere.
Flager says the industry has updated its wastewater treatment systems, but the technology that would allow it to meet the stricter end of pipe discharge standard does not exist. He says the cruise lines can meet stricter standards for fecal coliform, but not for copper and ammonia.
If the technology cannot meet the standards, then the cruise lines are not going to apply for a permit that they lawfully cannot abide by. And this may have an effect on itineraries and times in port for the local communities.
Flager wouldn't say if those itinerary changes would result in dropped port calls or just shorter visits to communities. He says past environmental mistakes by cruise lines may have played a role in the passage of the cruise ship initiative 3 years ago.
I think there were some standards maybe that are regretful by some of the companies, but I think that they have been fixed. I think we all look at the environment differently today than we did as little as 10 years ago and certainly as 20 years ago.
Pleger says the initiative is not all bad and the Ocean Rangers program is working better than expected. He says the only legislative change the industry is seeking this session is the requirement that cruise lines meet water quality standards at the time of discharge. Cohen says any talk of lifting a cruise ship mixing zone prohibition is premature. He says DEC is hosting a conference this month to examine technologies that may be available to cruise lines that would allow them to potentially meet water quality standards without mixing zones.
First of all, I do believe that there will be technology fixes that are made apparent by this meeting. Second, even if there weren't, there's still always the option for them to discharge on shore and run their discharges through a local facility. And while some of the local facilities are not that good either, right now, they can be improved.
As of Wednesday, no legislation had yet been introduced this session to amend the cruise ship discharge requirements. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Locally grown oysters are suspected as the source of an acute gastrointestinal outbreak in Sitka. 25 people have been identified with a gastrointestinal illness, and four of the patients have tested positive for norovirus infection. Weld Royal, spokeswoman for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, says oysters from Whiting Harbor Aquafarms, LLC, appear to be the source of the outbreak.
The Sitka grower has voluntarily stopped selling the oysters, and we are sending out the oysters for testing to confirm that they are the source. We do believe they come from this grower.
Royal says Whiting Harbor has cooperated with the Departments of Health and the DEC, but she says Sitkins should be aware that oysters purchased in late January could be contaminated.
We would like to ask consumers to, you know, check their freezers and their local supply of oysters. And if they have purchased oysters, if they purchased oysters between January 26th and February 1st from Whiting Harbor, they should either be returned to the place of purchase or be discarded.
The DEC is also asking people who experienced an onset of symptoms starting January 30th or later and within 2 days of eating Sitka oysters to report their illness by calling the Department of Health. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Janelle Everett in Barrow, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.